When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
A biting wind whistles as it blows across the grassy mound of earth in the graveyard beside Scoon Abbey in eastern Scotland. The party of powerful Scottish barons and bishops on the hill pull their fur-lined cloaks tightly around themselves. A few of them blow on their hands to try and warm them and stamp their feet to keep the blood flowing. It's the last day of November, St. Andrew's Day, in 1292. The light at this time of year is low and weak. The temperature never gets much above bone-chilling, and the wind and rain constantly swirl in from the vast expanse of the grey North Sea. The soft drone of the bagpipes and drums coming from the direction of the abbey get lost in the whip of the breeze. Even the gulls who hover in the wind struggle to make their screeching heard over it. But if the weather is bleak, this is still a must-see occasion. On top of this little mound, known as Moot Hill, stands a stone cross. Beside it is a hunk of sandstone, carved into the shape of a brick, but the size of a chair. It's been covered today in black silks, trimmed with gold embroidery. It's known as the Stone of Destiny, or the Stone of Scoon. It's said to be as old as the Bible. Some even say that it was the stone the Old Testament patriarch Jacob used as a pillow in one of the stories from Genesis. This has been a sacred stone in Scotland for centuries, used in coronation ceremonies for hundreds of years. And on this ancient piece of rock, a new King of Scots is about to be crowned. His name is John Baliol, and he's only here, sitting on the Stone of Scoon, after an agonisingly long legal process overseen by the Plantagenet King of England, Edward I. The result of Edward's beauty contest to select Baliol was announced less than 2 weeks ago, so the coronation has been a bit of a rush job. Not least because there hasn't been a coronation in Scotland for more than 40 years. But now it's happening, and Baliol is getting the regalia of monarchy, a crown on his head, a sceptre in his hand, and men bearing swords standing behind him. He's also getting a lecture. The guests at the coronation watch as a dignified, grey-haired Highlander, a bard or shunachie, wearing a distinctive red cloak, steps out before them and clears his throat. It's his job to remind John Baliol exactly what a distinguished royal line he comes from. Raising his voice over the wind, the bard begins reciting in Gaelic the names of Baliol's royal predecessors. Men with names like David and Duncan, Malcolm and Kenneth, all the way back to the maybe legendary first King of Scots, Fergus. It's a long list, because Scotland has a proud and ancient royal history. But as the bard runs through it, some of the barons assembled have got to be asking themselves, is that history about to end with a whimper? John Baliol may have his buttocks planted on the Stone of Destiny, but he's only king on the say-so of the big Plantagenet bully, Edward I. When Edward agreed to give his opinion on who should succeed the late King Alexander III, he was only meant to be offering advice. Instead, he's made the process, known as the Great Cause, needlessly long and complicated. It's left the Scots with the disturbing impression that not only did he have the right to choose their king for them, but he's now the overlord of the kingdom, with a right to get up in their business whenever he feels like it. This is very much not what they bargained for, but what the Scots are going to get, once Baliol has been enthroned on the sacred stone of Scone, is a whole lot more of not what they bargained for. A month after Baliol's coronation, Edward makes him cross the border into northern England and come to see him at the castle of Norham. There, Edward orders Baliol to perform the ceremony of homage, kneeling before him and swearing to become his faithful servant. 4 days after that, Edward issues an official statement telling the Scots that no matter what they thought, or indeed what he said, during the deliberations over the throne, he considers himself the ultimate power in the British Isles. And to show he's not joking, he starts to allow Scottish legal cases to be run in English courts. This is more than just a boring technicality. It strikes at the very heart of what it means to be a king, which is the ultimate enforcer of the law, like RoboCop, with a crown and a load of castles. When Baliol plonked himself down on the stone of Scone, he was supposed to become the supreme power in Scotland. It turns out he's been made nothing more than Edward's puppet. The disappointment and anger in Scotland is palpable, and unsurprising. Edward doesn't really give a monkey's about any of that, though. As far as he can see, this is a job well done. He smashed Wales in his early reign, now he's put the Scots in their place. It's time for him to turn his attention to the job he really wants to get done, which is going back to the Holy Land on crusade to fight the Mamluks. That's the slave soldier dynasty who've risen up to take command of Egypt and are now overrunning the whole of the Crusader Kingdom of Jerusalem. But if Edward thinks he has a free pass to canter off to the east, he's in for a shock. He may have bullied the Scots mercilessly, but he's not going to get away with it that easily. Because there's nothing a bully hates so much as being bullied themselves. And Edward is about to get a taste of his own medicine. I'm Dan Jones, and from Sony Music Entertainment, this is History. Season 4 of A Dynasty to Die For. Episode 11, The Sword and the Stone.
Do you ever wonder how celebrities order food? Like, is Sarah Paulson a Diet Coke or a regular Coke girly?
Some peasant Coke? No.
Or how does Sofia Vergara order a pizza?
No tomatoes. I cannot eat tomatoes.
Are you killed mushrooms?
Not really.
Okay. If these are the details you need, and I know you do, I have the podcast for you. I'm Jesse Tyler Ferguson, and on my podcast, Dinner's on Me, I take some notable friends of mine out to dinners in Los Angeles and New York City. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
That thing was delicious.
Edward I is one of the most effective kings the Plantagenets ever produce. But there's something he has in common with the other effective Plantagenets, like Henry II and Richard the Lionheart. They never know when to leave a thing alone. At the root of it, that's what happens with Edward I in Scotland in the 1290s. He can't resist throwing his weight around. And as a result, he gets his comeuppance, and the history of Anglo-Scottish relations takes a major turn for the worse for nearly 300 years. But it starts in a weird place, not in Scotland at all, but in Gascony, Edward's one remaining bit of French territory, all that's left of his great-grandmother Eleanor's once mighty duchy of Aquitaine. What happens is this. In 1292, as Edward is bullying John Baliol, English, Gascon and French sailors are fighting running sea battles in the English Channel. It's half merchant stuff, half straight-up piracy. Call it what you will. These sea battles are vicious clashes, with ships sunk and men drowned. It's clear that heads need to be knocked together. Or at least it's clear to Philip IV, King of France. The handsome, stony-faced, obsessive monarch tells his sailors to chill out and stop causing trouble. Then he also orders Edward to rein in his own sailors. Philip does this in his capacity as overlord of Gascony, Edward's boss. This isn't a friendly request between kings mutually interested in peace. It's a direct order. The sort of thing that Edward has been doing to John Balliol, in fact. Of course, when the boot is on the other foot, Edward doesn't like it one bit. He drags his heels and refuses to chastise the Anglo-Gascon sailors. So Philip, who's just as capable of bully boy tactics as Edward is, presses the nuclear button. He declares Edward has forfeited Gascony. He's taking it off him and reclaiming it for France. To show he's serious, Philip sends some of his finest bagmen and thugs down to Gascony to make arrests. There's a ruthless one-eyed lawyer called Pierre Flotte, and a gang of enforcers, including one guy who's known only by the nickname Cheese. It gets pretty nasty. Cheese and his mates start getting heavy with the locals, so they're captured and arrested by Edward's men, sentenced to death and hanged. When Cheese is strung up, he has his mouth jammed full of sticks so that he can't make a formal appeal to the laws of France before he dies. When word of this outrage gets back to Philip, he ups the ante and prepares troops to start confiscating castles in Gascony and blocking the ports needed for the wine trade. Which seems crazy. It's only a generation ago that old Henry III and Louis IX of France agreed the Treaty of Paris, which was supposed to be England and France's John and Yoko moment. Give peace a chance and all that. Well, now it looks very much like peace is on the way out. Throughout 1293, the two realms are on the brink of war. Edward deploys his brother Edmund over to Paris to try and negotiate with Philip IV. The idea is that Edward, who's been unmarried since his beloved Eleanor died, will marry Philip's sister Margaret to seal the deal. But things get, well, complicated. Somehow or other, Philip manages to persuade Edward and Edmund that there's only one way they can all get out of this ugly situation saving face. What he proposes is this. The English should give up the leading towns and castles in Gascony to his men, and Philip will issue an official proclamation condemning them for being very naughty boys. But this will only be for show. Philip will then invite Edward to a grand ceremony of reconciliation and give him Gascony back on more favourable terms than it was held before. The marriage deal between Edward and Margaret can go ahead. Big smiles, short memories, job done. Edward and Edmund spend a good while negotiating this with Philip in great secrecy, and Edward hardly lets anyone know what he's up to. Which is unfortunate, because anyone with half a brain would surely have told him that this is completely insane. But Edward seems to have drunk his own Kool-Aid, believing that with everything he's managed to achieve in crushing the Welsh and Scots, he can easily outwit Philip IV. On this occasion, however, he gets played. In early 1294, French officials go into Gascony and start to take possession of towns and castles, as the agreement with Philip stipulates. In the spring, Edward waits for the summons to go and meet Philip and have it all handed back to him. He waits, and he waits, and he waits. And guess what? Philip ghosts him. In fact, he does worse than that. Not only does he not summon Edward to get Gascony back on good terms, he lets it be publicly known that Gascony is confiscated forever, and the orderly transfer into French hands is underway. It's incredibly embarrassing. It's also, rather ironically, the sort of thing Edward has done to the Scots. Dissembling, wheedling, and just lying outright were a major part of Edward's MO during the Great Cause. Now he knows what it feels like to be on the receiving end. What's more, he has to get Gascony back, which means a full-blown war with France, the sort of thing that brought his granddad King John's reign collapsing around him. So from the summer of 1294, Edward is scrambling to raise huge taxes, huge loans, and all the men, weapons, and provisions he can lay his hands on. He sends men, including his brother Edmund, over to begin trying to take back key locations in sieges and skirmishes. But to keep it all going, he needs to tap the resources of anyone and everyone that owes him military service or any other form of support. And somewhere on that list, fairly near the top, is John Baliol, the man he handed the keys to the Kingdom of Scotland, and who he feels he can still treat like his pet poodle. John Baliol, however, is very much unable to help. Because in 1295, Edward gets some shocking news from Scotland. The Scottish barons, sick and tired of having a poodle for a king, have rebelled against Baliol. They've put a council around him to take all the key decisions in government and blocked him from ruling on his own. The first big decision they've taken is to send ambassadors south to make a peace treaty. But those ambassadors don't head to England. They go to France to negotiate with Philip IV, the enemy of my enemy and all that. In October 1295, a mutual defence pact is agreed between Scotland and France, in which they agree to help each other to fend off any attack from the Kingdom of England. It's the start of a deal known to history as the Old Alliance. It sandwiches Edward and his successors between two enemy realms, and means that from now on, Plantagenet kings can never feel totally confident about going to war in France without worrying that their northern borders are going to be overrun. In 1292, after he put Baliol on the Scottish throne, Edward thought he was the king of the castle. Now, he looks like a total clown. His crusade has never seemed further away. The war in Gascony is burning cash at a terrifying rate. And now he has to deal with the Scots, who've had the nerve to defy him. In 1296, he sends an army north to teach them a lesson. On March the 1st, 1296, Edward inspects his army as it arrives near Berwick, the first big Scottish town across the border from northern England. It's a major force, alive with the sounds of men readying themselves for war, clapping each other on their armour and leather-clad backs, shouting encouragement to one another and psyching themselves up by banging metal gauntlets above their helmets. Just off the coast, Edward has a fleet waiting to disembark further troops if necessary. It's an overwhelming display of English military might, and if the townsfolk of Berwick have any sense, they won't try and stand in its way. Edward has already sent them orders to open their gates and spare him the need to do some real damage. As he waits for their reply, He keeps himself busy by honouring English pre-battle tradition and dubbing some of the young warriors in his army's ranks as knights. It's a big moment for these youngsters, but for Edward, it's all part of a power play. He knows that from beyond the cheap wooden fence that passes for the town's main defences, the citizens are watching. He wants them to see what a fierce and noble force they're dealing with. But he's in for a surprise. As he goes through with the knighting ritual, there's a cry from a watchtower that rises above the wooden fence. It's a messenger, obviously representing the people of Berwick. He's trying to catch the attention of someone important on the English side, maybe even Edward himself. When everyone's looking, the messenger delivers the people's response to Edward. It's honest, straightforward, and unambiguous. He turns around, hoiks down his trousers, and waves his bare behind in the English king's direction, slapping his hands on the cheeks for good measure. Behind him, a whole load of other townspeople also crowd onto the platform, hooting and jeering and calling the English every foul name under the sun. It doesn't look that much like Berwick is going to surrender. Which only leaves Edward with one option. He has a big army, battering rams and war catapults, fire and fury. It'll take him approximately 30 seconds to punch a hole in those flimsy town defences. No one makes a fool of him and gets away with it. So Edward turns to his army and gives the order to start the advance on Berwick immediately. The instructions are simple. Head in the direction of that cheeky git's hairy butt cheeks, and when you get there, kill him and everyone else you can. The assault on Berwick, which begins Edward's 1296 invasion of Scotland, is a taste of things to come. It takes Edward no time at all to smash down the town's defences and massacre the citizens. Edward then stays in Berwick, has his engineers build proper defences around the town, and sends out threatening messages to John Balliol and anyone else who feels like dying, warning them that they're next. Yet as much as Edward has the overwhelming military force, the one thing he can't seem to do is bring the Scots to what he considers their senses. Instead of surrendering and sending flowers to say sorry, John Balliol sends Edward a message of defiance. This time it's not in the form of a Scotsman's derriere, but the general gist is the same. Balliol tells Edward he can poke his homage where the sun don't shine. The allegiance he swore was squeezed out of him under duress. Scotland is independent, and he's his own king, even if he's not exactly a popular one with his people. In strategic terms, this is truly crazy. Edward has the manpower to leave half of Scotland the way he's left Berwick, a smouldering wreck controlled by English soldiers. And indeed, that's what he does. Marching his army on a spring and summer tour around targets including Dunbar Castle, the Scottish capital of Edinburgh, and the important fortress at Stirling. Nowhere can hold out against the Sassenach juggernaut, and after a while, most of them don't bother trying. They wait for Edward to arrive, and then opt not to be slaughtered like cattle and have their homes burned. It's almost inevitable that by the summer, Balliol has folded like an origami swan. Edward offers him his life and a place as an earl in the English aristocracy if he'll give up his resistance. On July the 8th, Balliol meets Edward at Montrose for a humiliating ceremony that's basically the reverse of a coronation. He's ritually stripped of his crown and the insignia of kingship, culminating in having the royal arms of Scotland ripped off his coat, which earns him the nickname Tomb Tabard, meaning empty coat. Edward sends him off to the Tower of London as a prisoner and, surprise surprise, goes back on his promise to make him an English earl. Then, to ensure that the Scots can't install another king in Balliol's place, and to reinforce the message that he is master of the British Isles, Edward goes even further. He doesn't just hammer the Scots. He does something that will undermine and insult the country for generations. He sends men to steal the Stone of Scone, the sacred rock on which Scottish kings have for so long been crowned. They take it down to Westminster Abbey, and Edward has a magnificent wooden chair custom-built to keep it in. It's actually the same chair that kings and queens of the United Kingdom are still crowned on to this day. The Stone of Destiny is destined to stay in England for a long, long time. Exactly 700 years, to be precise. It's confiscated in 1296 and doesn't get returned until within my own lifetime, in 1996. From now on, Edward has decided, there's not going to be a King of Scotland at all. He sends one of his toughest lieutenants, the Earl of Surrey, to be the governor of the kingdom. To be fair, he's had his fill of it. When he hands over the Seal of Scotland, which is the official symbol of the realm, he says to the Earl of Surrey that, "A man does good business when he rids himself of a turd." Yet Edward, for all his bluster, bravado, and arrogance, isn't ridding himself of anything. Because what happens in Scotland in 1296 sets a tone in more ways than one. English armies flexing their muscles is one part of the story. But the other part is the spirit which Baliol briefly showed when he sent his message of defiance to Edward. A message that defied military logic and spoke to raw, proud Scottish independence rather than common sense. Edward can burn all the towns he likes and steal all the rocks in the kingdom. But Scotland is going nowhere. And the Scots are never going to lie down and suffer the English jackboot on their throats. Which is exactly what we're going to discover next time, in the season finale of This Is History. And if you want a hint of what's coming up, I've got one word for you.
Freedom!